What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Marty Bent is the editor-in-chief of Marty's Bent, a daily newsletter about Bitcoin. The host of Gamcast, a podcast about Bitcoin and oil and gas. The host of Tales from the Crypt, a podcast about Bitcoin. Co-host of the weekly Rabbit Hole Recap. And he is leading the way in bringing the market to Molecule at Great American Mining, which is harvesting organic waste fuels while securing the world's first engineered monetary network, aka Bitcoin. If you're not paying attention, you probably should be. Marty Bent, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Doing well. I'm very happy to be here. I think finally able to get this interview in the books. I feel like.
Yeah, it's taken a minute to come together, but I'm super excited to have you on. You know, to be honest, for me, you were kind of a beacon, your pod, when I was first coming into Bitcoin. You were the first podcast in this space where I started to enjoy your responses and view almost or if not more than the guests. And so I was actually coming to the podcast to hear you. So I really appreciate everything you do in the space. I've been very inspired by you and happy to get right into it. I'd love to hear more about what's going on in Great American Mining. And I'm kind of curious, I think you, before you were even there, you did a stint at some valuations company or finance company. And I kind of figure out, like, how does that fit into, you know, your path?
Yeah, so I had a short stint at a third-party valuations company end of 2016, beginning of 2017 out of Philadelphia. And they basically did third-party valuations for private equity firms with exposure to pre-public mid-market companies. And so we would look at their financials and their EBITDA ratios and their projected cash flows and pitch back a evaluation recommendation to the private equity firms. And so during that stint, I had some mid-market oil and gas companies come across my desk. So got some exposure to some of the companies and their financials. And it was very interesting from that perspective to see how some producers, not all, but a lot, misallocated capital in the mid 2010s, between 2010 and 2020. That was a short stint before I started the newsletter. It was right before I started the newsletter. Before that, I worked in software sales in New York, selling offshore software development talent. And before that, I worked at a managed futures fund as an analyst, indexing commodities trading, commodity trading advisors into a fund of funds, where I learned a lot about the global macro landscape, currency markets, and commodities markets as well, including oil and gas, from a macro perspective, the sort of supply and demand drivers in the markets. So yeah, I've had a meandering career. I've gone in and out of finance and finally landed in the future of finance, which is Bitcoin. But it's been a fun ride. I'm rounding up my 20s now. I turned 30 in a few months here, and it's crazy to see the sort of path I've taken as I look back. If you would have told 20-year-old Marty what he would have gotten into over the last decade, he would have been like, what the hell are you doing with your life? But it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm curious there, like, how does Barstool Sports fit into that career path of yours? It wasn't name drop there.
Yeah, so that was after the valuations firm. The valuations firm, I mean, very interesting. I like the information. It's actually crazy that we're talking about this right now, because I actually had a dream about this. The valuations firm I used to work with, like the people I used to work with last night. So it's funny. And this just like sparked my memory of that dream. But it was great experience, just from a insight into the financials of some of these pre-public companies and how private equity firms disperse capital and allocate capital. But it was another cubicle job where you're just looking at Excel sheets and doing the same thing, plugging in EBITDA ratios, DCFs, IRR rates and spitting out valuations, and it was just like too monotonous for me. And so I decided, and I was doing that in Philadelphia while my wife and I were actually living in Brooklyn. And so I would commute and live at my cousin's house in Philly during the week and then go home to Brooklyn on the weekends. And it was just a little bit too much for me. And so I decided to venture back into unemployment and take a few months to figure out what I wanted to do. That's when I started the newsletter, Marty's Bent. And that was like June 2017. So the price of Bitcoin was going up. It's a Bitcoin that was able to hold me over, which I regret spending, but that's a story for another day. So the newsletter started, and I saw one of the guys from Barstool tweeting about like Ethereum and telling stoolies to buy Ethereum, like literally around the US dollar top the first time around, like around in the Bitcoin top the first time around, like the summer of 2017. And I DM'd him. I was just like, dude, I don't think you should be like giving financial advice like to the Barstool audience in this frothy speculative market. And we developed a relationship, and he really liked the newsletter, and he read it, and we met for drinks one day. He's like, you need to start a podcast. I mean, podcasting was pretty big then, but it's like nowhere near what it is now. And the amount of Bitcoin content out there in the podcasting realm wasn't massive. And so he was like, hey, like people like this newsletter, like I'm sure they'd like a podcast too. So he helped me start the podcast. So we go into Barstool's office and record after hours with him and some guests. And then I was still unemployed. I was like, it's like, Lou, like I need a job. Like I'll do anything at Barstool. Been a stoolie for quite a while. And he was an ad sales manager. And so he was like, you want to be one of my account managers? I was like, yeah, I'll do literally anything. So just by nature of recording the podcast, I snuck my way into an account manager job and did that for 7 months before Great American Mining found me.
Got it. Yeah, I kind of probably inversed the order of that. I assumed you were at Barstool Sports before the pod and the newsletter. That was kind of my inferment there. So that was kind of enlightening. So you roll into, or Great American Mining finds you. And what is the story there? What are they doing? And maybe what is the origin story of Great American Mining?
Yeah, it's a really interesting origin story. So Great American Mining spun out of a parent company known as Buy Sell Ads. So Buy Sell Ads is basically like an online platform where publishers and advertisers can meet, and publishers can monetize their sites, and advertisers can get their products in front of a very concentrated and devoted niche audience across the web. Our CEO, Todd Garland, bootstrapped that company beginning in like 2008, 2009, I believe. It's very early on in the ad days. And it's funny, we're a Bitcoin company coming out of an ad tech. It's a bit opposite. But Todd's really main purpose of starting that is like he just liked niche content creators and sort of niche content themes, and wanted to be able to help those content creators monetize. And at the time, advertising was the best and only way to a certain degree. And so he created this white label service, allowed publishers to basically plug it in and get access to a marketplace where advertisers could buy ad space. And just the nature of that business got introduced to Bitcoin publishers, data publishers in the Bitcoin space in like 2014, 2015. And a few of them, actually, it's funny enough, Roger Ver specifically at Bitcoin.com asked him if he would accept, like actually forced him to basically create a payments flow that would allow buy-sell ads to accept Bitcoin. And then he convinced Todd, like, hey, if you're accepting Bitcoin, I want you to hold the ad profits that BSA gets in Bitcoin. And Todd was like, all right, it's a very profitable business, very strong cash flows. He's like, yeah, I have no problem doing that. So he started accumulating Bitcoin via BSA in like 2015, 2016, and considerable amount of Bitcoin. Bull market 2017 happens, and he sees the appreciation of the Bitcoin assets on his balance sheet. And he's like, holy crap, this thing's real. And he sort of fell headfirst down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and naively probably decided he wanted to get into mining. He became really passionate about Bitcoin and helping it succeed. and decided the best way he's going to do that was by getting into the mining industry. So Green American Mining started in like literally the height of the last bull market in December of 2017. We got in on that Dragon Mint early order that really didn't turn out to be what it was advertised as, and we made a lot of naive mistakes early on, but yeah, we kept with it. I joined the company again like April, May 2018, and essentially we were in quasi stealth mode for a couple of years as we attempted to find cheap energy at scale, and so we really honed in on the natural gas, the stranded natural gas, particularly flared natural gas. By accident, our head engineer, Reed Browning, was at a state fair in Utah, where he's from, and he has a petroleum and chemical engineering background. He's worked in oil and gas his whole career, even at the EPA, and he was sort of explaining to a buddy at the state fair who's in oil and gas our problem that we were trying to solve at Green American Mining, which is like cheap, abundant energy. And this gentleman just so happened to run a water treatment facility for brackish water. And he said, yeah, I've got a flare on my site. If you want to come plug in a generator and try to use that as an energy source or an electricity source to run your miners, come and try it out. I'll just give it to you. And so that's where we built our first prototype. It worked. And we looked at like the economics if we were to go sort of source similar deals with this particular energy source, and we were like, holy crap, maybe this is our avenue to get cheap energy at scale. And so since then, we've been iterating on our container designs and our relationships in the oil and gas industry, and really just going full bore for the last year and a half now. Attempting to just perfect everything and now try to get the scale that we've been thinking of for 4 years, 3 years, yeah. 3.5 years.
It's very interesting. To me, there's two sides of the coin here. One is the Bitcoin desire to find this cheap energy, but the other side is the legacy industry, the energy, the oil and gas industry. How do they view stranded or flared gas?
It depends on the particular producer in what part of the country or world they're in. Most of them just view it as, I mean, it's literally called like a nuisance gas, particularly like North Dakota. Like it's a nuisance because when you IP a well, you're not only getting oil, there's a ton of gas coming out as well. And with all the ESG movements and the need to curb greenhouse gas emissions being thrust at the industry from the federal and state level, natural gas is seen as a nuisance because when you're IPing these wells, there isn't always pipeline infrastructure for the gas to get that to market. And so they have to flare this gas because they have nothing to do with it. They can't just vent it unless they want to get knocked by the EPA for being like ultra polluters. So they just set it on fire, combust it. And depending on where you are in the country, like in North Dakota, if you flare a certain amount, you have to stop your oil production. And it's a nuisance in that regard. And the natural gas, there's such an abundance of it. The supply of natural gas is so immense that like even if you were able to get pipeline infrastructure out to these pads, it's not the like marketing the gas, getting it refined, and then finally getting to market by the time it gets to the end consumer and they're paying for it. They're making pennies of the dollar, if not, like sometimes spending money to do all that. So the oil is the money maker in the industry, and that's all the, not all, but that's mainly what the producers are focused on, is getting oil out of the ground and to market to profit, and it is very profitable for them. And the natural gas is a nuisance, and even if it is a positive revenue driver, it's a very small percentage in most cases.
Right. So there's definitely a few angles here. I mean, the value of the gas, I guess, being flared, but also depending on which state you are, you know, some states don't care, I guess, about the flared gas, or don't care as much, or don't cap production based on flared gas. Is a lot of the business model for Great American Mining, especially, I think, as you were rolling this out, and before we get into Bitcoin, was it really around predicated on regulatory arbitrage?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, in a sense, where regulatory, I mean, we stumbled into regulatory arbitrage where we needed cheap energy. And we knew that flaring was a problem in the Bakken in North Dakota specifically. And we said, hey, yeah, like we'll help you curb your flaring so you don't have to shut down oil production. It's that simple. And like, not only are you going to not have to spend money to flare, you're going to make money on that gas that you would have otherwise flared because we'll pay you for it instead of you literally spending money to set it on fire. So they're more than happy to see us come up and say like, hey, yeah, we'll do like an offtake agreement with you. We'll buy the gas. We just need to make sure that we get a steady stream of it for X amount of time. I mean, a lot of interesting lessons learned too. As a pure flare mitigation service, you find out that you find out some interesting lessons. Like we learned a lesson in the Bakken where we engaged as a flare mitigation service and didn't actually own the gas. We didn't do an offtake agreement. And we found out that like the pipelines actually have a lot more control over the gas than producers. So when the crash in April of last year happened in the oil markets and producers started shutting in oil and gas wells that opened up capacity in the pipeline. So that gas we were using on one of the well pads that we were on. The pipeline had capacity open up and the pipeline said, hey, we're going to take that gas. You don't own that. And so yeah, we try to do offtake agreements with producers now to make sure that we have full control of that gas.
Right. In the framework of the offtake agreement, has there been a transition from, hey, we're just happy to have you mitigate this flare, to we want to get in on the action of the value add of being on the Bitcoin play now? Is from the legacy ONG community, what has been there, if any, has there been a transition from their standpoint?
Yeah, again, it depends on the producer, particularly the size of the producer. Again, the bigger guys are making so much money on the oil and have their gas handling down to a science almost. And again, they're making so much money with the oil that it's like, the scale at which Bitcoin mining can help out the gas problem they have at this particular juncture just isn't there. It will be there in the future. But yeah, so the smaller, medium-sized producers, mom and pop shops, they're really affected by this. They're more willing to get excited about the Bitcoin stuff, especially if they're in weird financial straits. But yeah, it all depends on the amount of capital they're able to deploy into this, whether or not they can participate as much as they'd like in the Bitcoin mining. But there are ways to ways to engage with these producers in different ways, depending on what they have to bring to the table. Like if you bring gas to the table, you're willing to give it to us for free. And if you have generator assets on site that you're not using and you're willing to let us use those too, to generate electricity with your gas. Like, yeah, that's putting skin in the game. So we'd be more than happy to share Bitcoin revenues with you. But yeah, there's most popular engagement right now are these offtake agreements. And again, and most producers are risk averse when it comes to Bitcoin. They still view it as like some weird thing. But obviously, the price of Bitcoin going up has certainly shifted conversations towards, all right, like explain this to us, like why should we be paying attention to it? We haven't seen full adoption with all the producers we're engaged with, but people, we do work with some producers that are taking a rip of the Bitcoin and holding it.
Right. In terms of how stranded is some of this flared gas, like off grid or no cell phone service, no electricity or something like that? And what is the process or what does this look like from an operational standpoint, one rig? Like how are you generating or running flared gas to a generator to mine Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I can get really remote to the point where we have to like bring in satellite internet infrastructure to use that. Like most of the places we use don't have like fiber. That's the beauty of Bitcoin mining. Like the bandwidth needed to send hashes to a mining pool is relatively small compared to other data center services, if you will, if you want to throw Bitcoin mining in that bucket. So we can leverage cellular data and satellite internet infrastructure. So pretty remote areas, very remote in some cases. But again, it's not a problem for us. And the infrastructure on site, I mean, it's pretty simple, right? You just like instead of piping the gas to a flare stack. You just pipe it to generators, and depending on the BTU content of that gas, maybe you need to put a scrubber in or a water tower or bubble tower, excuse me, to get some of the liquids out. But yeah, it's pretty straightforward infrastructure. You pipe it to a generator instead of a flare stack. You get the generators, depending on the scale of the operation, you probably daisy chain a few generators together, so that if one goes down, you're not taking the whole mining operation down. If you have significant scale at one well pad with an immense amount of gas, you can bring turbines on and use those as power generation, which help drive costs down even further. But yeah, it's pretty straightforward. You just get pipe, scrubber if you need it, generators, and then yeah, the miners in the shipping containers.
What kind of like hash power are we talking about in one of these maybe larger operations? And what would be like a way to figure out, or how can you value the ROI on something like this?
Yeah, I mean, you certainly can, right? There's a, you could just look at the capital outlay depending on what mining machines you're buying, what generation equipment you need. It's pretty straightforward. You can look at the amount of hash rate that's being produced in the container and the network difficulty and cumulative hash rate at any given point in time, and sort of ballpark a payback period. With the price of Bitcoin going up, it's pretty quick payback compared to other.
What if it was static? The price just, you know,
the price is static, it's hash rate static too.
Sure. Let's in that imaginary model, like what kind of numbers are we talking about that can be, you know, maybe to just kind of get at the value of this stranded gas in Bitcoin terms.
I mean, so it ranges anywhere, I'll put it this way, from anywhere from like 11 to 24 months, depending on if you're in a bull or bear market, which isn't bad, right? Because the machines, if you're buying newer generation machines or even a generation or two behind, is like as we see with the S9, which launched in 2015, they're still around 6 years later. So if you just have to do a couple of rebuilds of the generators, and your miners are going to last for 4 to 6 years, the 2 year payback period really isn't that bad. You're playing with house money for 2 years plus,
right,
with some generator rebuilds.
Yeah, but so earlier in the conversation, you alluded to the misallocation of like capital within the legacy oil and gas industry. How do you think like what Great American Mining is doing like changes the opportunity cost for them?
Yeah, it significantly changes it, right? Right now at this moment, oil is the main money market. It's like all these producers care about is getting as much oil out of the ground into market as possible so they can make as much money as possible. And so that misallocation of capital I was alluding to earlier that I got a bit of insight into while working at that valuations firm was some producers were taking out crazy loans, like $100 million, 17% PIK loans, which are like ridiculously bad for the borrower. In 2012, and they were projecting that they were going to be able to pay it back in 4 years because the price of a barrel of oil would be like $80 to $100. And they would just take this loan and poke as many holes in the ground to get as much oil as possible, and they'd have to make up for that that lack of appreciation in the price for a barrel of oil with volume. So they're poking holes and trying to get as much oil out of the ground and get as much to market as possible. And arguably it led to a misallocation of capital. They probably drilled more wells. They definitely drilled more wells than is necessary to meet demand and be able to run a profitable business for themselves. And so what Bitcoin mining off of what they typically view as nuisance gas does to the opportunity cost, it allows them making better decisions, right? Instead of gas being responsible for 3 to 5% of their revenue, maybe it jumps up to like 20 to 30%, maybe even higher. And so that's a considerable revenue stream and profit driver that leads to a different sort of allocation of capital and decision making at the business level. Like, do we really need to drill that many wells? Like, when we drill a well, maybe we can choke the well, which means we'll take out gas and oil slower and just milk it for a longer period of time. We know we can do something with that gas. Do we invest in pipeline infrastructure? Do we actually need to get this gas to market? Can we just consume it here and convert it to energy here and turn it into Bitcoins instead of building a multi-million dollar pipeline project that goes across state lines and comes with a bunch of headaches from the permitting level and the environmentalist attacking this level. So it definitely shifts the variables that go into the decision-making process at the business level and by extension, the opportunity cost of the types of decisions they make, they make those unpopular. And another thing is time, right? Like we engage with producers that still really don't care about the gas, and they don't want to monetize. They want to engage in an offtake agreement with us. They don't want to participate in the Bitcoin yet, but they want to get the oil out of the ground and get it to market. And what's stopping them is pipeline construction. Like they have to wait 18 months for a pipeline to be built to get to the well pad where they're at, and they want to start drilling right now. So when we can show up and say, hey, yeah, we can build these containers for you in 3 months instead of 18 and get it out there and consume that gas for you, and it shifts timelines as well.
Right. You know, you speak of like the pipelines and the capital intensive nature of the industry, but just the whole notion of like, we can't have a lot around these stranded energy sources because it's been trapped. So how does what you're doing at Great American Mining and sort of Bitcoin in general change maybe the opportunities or implications for society and the way we're built currently around ports or current easily accessible energy sources?
I mean, it shifts it massively. We can go use these stranded energy sources and make them profitable where they otherwise wouldn't be. You use it, you go, you tap into it, you mine Bitcoin with it. And then maybe you create like a mini grid out where this is, or like a mini power station, right? You're not only mining Bitcoin, but you're producing power beyond what you use to mine Bitcoin. They can then power other things like remote farming. That's how it starts. Maybe like remote farming systems, irrigation systems, whatever it may be. And then from there, you have something that adds on to that, and you add a little bit more energy capacity, and you build around this sort of mining operation, and it changes like the way humans aggregate around these energy sources, because you finally have a profitable way to convert these energy resources. You have a profitable way to monetize them, right? To convert them into a revenue stream. And it's the first time that we've been able to do that in human history. So you can, again, the pipeline infrastructure is necessary for local markets. And you're basically building literal pipelines to local markets to sell your gas. And that's the only market you can sell your gas to. Or if you use it to mine Bitcoin, you get accessibility to the global Bitcoin market. You sell it to a worldwide distributed peer-to-peer cash system immediately. And that's it. You just look at it as demand for your gas, particularly converting it to electricity to produce hashes, and eventually produce blocks that reward miners in Bitcoin. You're able to tap that very physical and geographical specific molecule and sell it to a global market, which is pretty crazy to think of.
Right. How do you think this affects like maybe nation states, like specifically maybe resource rich states where like, or even like wind, like Africa, maybe they have a lot of wind that's just not able to be, extracted from the local source and brought to the rest of civilization. But now there would be different opportunities in places like that.
Yeah. I mean, I've been writing about this a lot lately. Like, I think it's a theory. I can never prove this out until it happens, but right. I think we're going to see reversion, because we're not like reverting back in a sort of negative context, but like a return to city states that are predicated around these scarce energy sources. So like you can, particularly in the United States here, there's a lot of states that were affected by this federal ban on fracking on federal lands. And a lot of these states depend on the revenues provided from the oil and gas activities that go on the federal lands to literally fund, like permanent funds within the state, you know, to fund infrastructure, education, healthcare for the citizens of these particular states. And that's just been cut at the knees at the federal level because they're not able to extract that oil and gas and move it to a market. So if you think about it, like if these states that are in this crunch were able to fund mining infrastructure, maybe take out a low interest rate loan and engage somebody like Great American Mining to build out a mining operation on some of the shut-in gas wells that they have going, that they have within their borders that sort of don't go against the federal ban on fracking, but don't have the ability to make it to market otherwise. If they're strapped for cash or strapped for revenue, and their cash is dwindling because they're not able to actually get the tax revenue from the oil sales to put into a permanent fund, they invest in mining infrastructure and some stranded gas assets and plug in a mining operation. They could essentially fund those permanent funds with mining revenue, right? They could, right. They can mine Bitcoin and put portions of it into this permanent fund and fund that and just basically use their energy sources within their borders, monetize them immediately and lower taxes for their tax base. Say, hey, don't worry, the state on behalf of its citizens invested in mining infrastructure and we're going to roll these revenues into a permanent fund that's going to take care of infrastructure, education, healthcare. And then at a certain scale, they could, especially the energy rich states, they could turn around to the federal government saying federal funding in front of them with this carrot, and they could say, hey, we actually don't need you. Like we're doing pretty fine ourselves. We've got profitable mining operations. They're extremely, that's the other thing. They're cash flow positive almost immediately. You just plug them in, you're hashing, you're getting paid out Bitcoin multiple times a day, depending on what pool you're pointing your hash at. If you have somebody at the state level who's basically operating the mining operation economically and stewarding that particular operation responsibly and reinvesting the flows into the operation and growing the operation. There's no reason to think that you could basically turn away from the federal government, like just depend on yourself and actually lower taxes, potentially eliminate taxes for your tax base as well. Just using the mining operation as I hate to use the term UBI because it's not really UBI, but something akin to, maybe you've got skin in the game as a state, the taxpayers contributed to this, so you're going to benefit from it as well. I mean, we've seen examples of this in Alaska with their permanent fund and other states as well. So it's just taking this and applying it to a Bitcoin mining operation. You can get even more granular with that. Like some of these counties are very energy rich. I think you do it at the county level, you could do it right at the city level, and then you can see like states breaking up into smaller and smaller citadels, if you will.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought up the Alaska example. I mean, I think the precedent is there. It's just whether the mindset will change over and recognize the value proposition here. Is the energy industry a way of life?
It's a way of a quality of life, right? Right. I mean, we can live without the energy industry, but it just wouldn't be as good of a life. Right? That's what humans do. We're thrown into nature. Nature's very cruel and harsh. Mother Nature's a harsh mistress. She's a cruel bitch. And we are a very smart species, and we figured out how to sort of hone nature and use it to our best interest and provide a quality of life and a comfort that allows us to increase our lifespan, create things like the internet so we can video chat and do stuff like this right now. So I think like harnessing energy and using it to our benefit creates like a quality of life, right? Mm. We can certainly live without the energy industry, but it just wouldn't be as good of a life.
Right. That's interesting. So, you know, what do you think then about like the moralization of energy consumption in today's climate? And, you know, I mean, considering how much we need energy to do anything of value, But there seems to be this moralization around usage, specifically Bitcoin boiling the oceans.
Yeah. I mean, it's a rhetorical weapon by communists who want to force their way to the world on everybody else. Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's not logical at all. It all stems from the notion that Bitcoin doesn't provide any value, that Bitcoin isn't useful. I mean, that's the main argument. Like, Bitcoin is converting all this energy into electricity, and it's not providing the world with any value. This needs to stop. It's usually the argument. It's just objectively not true. I mean, it provides me value, it provides you value, I'm sure. We're seeing like P2P exchange value in sub-Saharan Africa is at all-time highs. I imagine it's providing those individuals value. It's providing people in Lebanon, Turkey, Iran, Venezuela, Argentina value as they try to escape hyperinflation. And yeah, the whole moralization, again, I think it stems from the fact that people can't control Bitcoin, particularly people who want to force communist views and communist sort of way of life on the rest of the world. And they try to, like anything, divide and conquer. And nothing gets people more worried or more riled up than an existential threat, or the idea of an existential threat. The climate is a very broad topic that obviously affects everybody on the planet. It can be used as a rhetorical tool to drive fear, to push a certain agenda. I think that's where it stems from. Right? It's like a lot of these people are tweeting from iPhones that are made with petroleum chemicals. They're doing it from hot tubs too, which take up a lot of energy. It's all bullshit, man.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt at all. I was wondering, like, and I know you've spoken on this before, but like, Bitcoin has to wear, I guess, its metrics on its sleeve. And I wonder, like, if, you know, people compared, you know, the usage of the energy that Netflix consumes, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on, like, how much Bitcoin's competitors use energy, like whether the Federal Reserve, the U.S. dollar, or what other competitors Bitcoin has.
Yeah, I mean, it's obscene amounts of energy. It's something that you have 11, like the large Navy ships, I forget what they're called off the top of my head.
Aircraft carriers?
Well, aircraft carriers. They take up like 8 megawatts of energy, or excuse me, gigawatts of energy or something like that, which is like equivalent to the Bitcoin network right now. And that's just like 11 weapons that are used by the U.S. Navy to protect the U.S. dollar reserve system at the end of the day. And so that's just one aspect of the U.S. military is those aircraft carriers. They alone are, I believe, I could be wrong on the stat, but I think they're consuming like gigawatts of energy. Then you get into like all the military bases we have around the world, all the oil that's used to fly everybody around, and all the oil that's used to create the weapons, all the energy that's used in the buildings that house the central banks and the commercial banks, the commutes of the people that work at those institutions to and from work, how much energy they're consuming. If they're now doing like work at home, like how much are their computers consuming? Is they video conference multiple times a day? You can't even quantify it. But again, like, we shouldn't moralize it. Like, if that's what it takes to do that stuff, like, that's what it takes. It's just having smarter conversations about energy use, whether it's a net negative or a net positive. I think without a doubt, it's been a net positive for humanity. There are certainly net negative particular uses of it. And we should reduce those when need be. But I don't think by any stretch of the imagination, Bitcoin would fall in a net negative. It is providing humanity with utility that has never existed before on this planet, a utility that has a lot of value for people in many parts of the world and for different reasons, right? It's valuable to me because it's a great savings vehicle. It's valuable to somebody in Venezuela because they can accept money from a family member abroad within their sanctioned country and buy goods with it that they desperately need. It's valuable to somebody in Nigeria as the government cuts them off because they don't like the political comments that they made about the Ansar's movement. They cut them off in the banking system and provides them the ability to accept and send money. I think it's a massive net positive for the world. And ironically, it's just making us more energy efficient. What we're doing at Great American Mining is going and taking an energy source that literally would have been set on fire and using it to create positive economic value in the form of Bitcoin. We're becoming more energy efficient with the Bitcoin, but that's too much of a nuanced discussion to have for most of the mainstream media, who just likes to divide and conquer and create boogeymen to scare people to force them to act a certain way.
Right. Speaking of boogeymen, another one is that, you know, China controls, you know, more than enough hash rate to do things to the network. I don't really want to get into the China FUD, but I do want to get into, like, what is really happening with mining and how decentralized it's getting. And maybe even how that affects geopolitics, like with Russia maybe doing mining in Iran and Venezuela and even America.
Yeah, I mean, I think mining is very distributed, very decentralized. But I think it could certainly be a lot more decentralized, particularly at the mining pool level and the chip fabrication level. So probably the most centralized part of mining right now is the mining pools. And more so the chip production, right? You have two main chip foundries that are creating the ASICs that make the Bitcoin mining world go around. It's not a lot of options. And they're in Taiwan and South Korea. So I'd like to see more foundries pop up that are able to produce Bitcoin ASICs. That would certainly give me more peace of mind. I'm very much looking forward to something like StrataV2 become more popular as a Bitcoin mining protocol layer. It makes mining more, it gives it a little bit more privacy as you're sending hashes to pools and allows individual miners to construct blocks. And then beyond that, we got to figure out how to make it so you can decentralize the reward distribution within pools as well. But over time, I think it's gotten more distributed, becoming significantly more distributed over time. I think that trend will continue in the future, particularly as the mining industry begins to bloom here in North America and the United States and Canada. I think you're going to see hash rate move away from China. We already have seen a considerable amount move away towards the West and in parts of Europe. And like you said, Africa's got a lot of energy, a lot of hydro in Africa that they can utilize. There's energy all over the world. That's what Bitcoin miners are. They're the energy consumers of last resort. And so wherever there's cheap energy, you bet there's a Bitcoin mining entrepreneur who's trying to figure out how to utilize it and turn it into Satoshis. And I confidence in human ingenuity that the people all over the world will figure this out, and mining will become sufficiently distributed over time. Again, I think it's pretty well distributed now. It was more centralized years ago, gotten more distributed as time has gone on. I think that will continue.
Yeah. How many miners or ASICs do you think are not plugged in right now that have already been distributed?
I mean, you can look at, hash rate has been going up the last few weeks. So I think a lot of these, particularly these publicly traded mining operations that made big orders last year, made big public announcements, are beginning to plug them in. I don't think they had them all in. I can't quantify the exact amount, but I would say there's a considerable amount of hash rate sitting stagnant on the sidelines because people don't know how to execute and like plug those in. They sort of shot first and trying to figure out how to do it on the back end.
How does that affect the Bitcoin network in terms of development or growth? Does that mean just a lot more power might come on at once down the road, or does that hold us back in any way?
No, I don't think it holds us back. I mean, as a miner, I love it. Leaves hash rate off the network artificially for longer than otherwise would happen if you had those miners in the hands of the people that could execute. And so our share of overall hash rate is higher as a result. So I like it in terms of, it's the beauty of the difficulty adjustment too. It makes it so the network is producing blocks at within the 10-minute target or around the 10-minute target consistently. So as long as we have that difficulty adjustment working like clockwork, like it does every 16 blocks, and as long as we have hashers all around the world, which we do, I think we're fine. And if the price goes up, the hash rate lags, it's good for miners. I don't think it says anything about the security of the network overall. At this particular juncture, it's not a problem, at least in my mind.
Right. What do you make of the Coinbase IPO and the lack of maybe Bitcoin on their balance sheet?
This is everybody expected Coinbase the IPO. I think it's a shame that they haven't been as Bitcoin focused as they can be, and the fact that they don't have much Bitcoin on their balance sheet is a shame, but it's whatever, teach their own. They Brian Armstrong and Anderson Horowitz and Fred Ersham and everybody at Coinbase, they're making a bet on the future of how everything's going to play out. And they're trying to execute on that bet. And it is a bet on a crypto multi-token world, which I don't agree with. I think their stock price is going to pump just because the retail market's looking for exposure to the Bitcoin ecosystem infrastructure, which Coinbase is certainly a part of. It'll be cool to watch play out tomorrow as they do their direct listing, and it'll be fun to see how high their valuation goes and whether or not they have a quick dip in recovery. It's expected. This is the path that Coinbase has been wanting to go down for a while. I wish they would have been more Bitcoin focused. I think they would be much more valuable if they were. It's hard to say. Like, they make a lot of money from shitcoin trading and that revenue. But they have a lot of engineering debt. Like, they can't even keep their app up and running or their exchange up and running when you have high volumes. Maybe that's just the product of them going out and trying to get all these revenues from listing these shit coins and letting people trade those. But yeah, it is what it is. It'll be, like it or not, it probably is a watershed moment for like the history of the cryptocurrency of Bitcoin industry. It was the first large retail exchange going public. Interesting story. It is what it is, though.
I agree. It is what it is. I try to think of no external entities or factors really affect Bitcoin. I kind of have a little bit of ill will towards Coinbase in terms of the shitcoinery and the way they place other coins in relation to Bitcoin at all. And I think that kind of tricks and manipulates the audience or retail. At the same time, I do agree that this seems to be a watershed moment. I wish it wasn't, but it seems to be sort of like a Google IPO for the internet age. And in that regard, I want it to do well, just so that there's a nice light on the space. But I'm not necessarily rooting for them. It's just that I think that we're tied together, but I don't want to feel like I am. So I'm twisted.
Yeah, no, I haven't interacted with Coinbase, the app, in many years. It was at a 30th birthday party over the weekend. Had a buddy's friend like thrust the Coinbase app in front of me and be like, "Are you buying VeChain?" And like just like seeing the front of his app, I was like, "This is Coinbase? These things?" It's like, holy shit. Like, looks like Blockfolio. To each their own. They made their bet on a multi-token future. I don't think it's going to be a wise one in the long run. This is a long-term reputation game. I think Brian Armstrong has burnt a lot of his reputational karma, if you will, throughout the years. He's going to make some money. He's going to secure his bag, which is denominated in fiat mostly, I imagine. It is what it is.
Yeah. Like I said earlier in the show, you know, a lot of your show is very influential. I mean, there's some episodes that really stuck out. One of them I'd like to get your take on was the episode with Ben Hunt and Epsilon Theory. And I'd like to hear what your take was going into that chat and kind of coming out of that chat.
Yeah. Ben's a very good writer. He's good at sort of breaking down these complex systemic problems within our financial and political systems and distilling them for an audience who likes to read stories, narrative-based stories. And he's somebody who I think gets that the world is fucked up and the incentives of financial world particularly are out of whack and are slated to disenfranchise the common Joe, common man, the average Joe. And so going into it, I was expecting him to jive and get Bitcoin and really champion Bitcoin as a way to sort of break away from that system. It's funny, like I did that interview at Chaincode Labs in their office, their beautiful office in New York, right in Midtown. I had James O'Byrne on to sort of sit on and add to the conversation as well. And I brought him to Chaincode specifically because I knew he was a bit skeptical of Bitcoin, but I wanted to bring him to Chaincode, a place where some of the smartest minds focused on the Bitcoin network literally meet to work on the protocol and sort of take him to like the source of actual development and get him focused on that instead of the pump and dump speculative nature of the token. Be like, hey, there's actual very smart people working on this stuff. Like, they're right here. You can see them. And then during the interview, I mean, his thesis is basically that Wall Street's going to co-opt the Bitcoin movement and make it a walled garden centralized system and it's trying to run away from. And we're all going to get, all the hardcore cypherpunk Bitcoiners are going to get proverbially dragged out into the streets and shot in the head for going against the empire, which is, I mean, I can see why he thinks that. It's just a bit disheartening that you're going to give up and basically declare Bitcoin a failed project before it even really gives a very strong fight in action against the state. But again, it is what it is. I think he's wrong. I think Bitcoin gives us the best chance to break away from this, and the trends that we're seeing in the space in terms of full node adoption, people moving their coins off exchange, like the amount of UTXOs and the overall supply that is held in personal custodies at a point that I don't think there's any turning back from, even if all these centralized parties were to stop individuals from moving the Bitcoin they have on exchanges and other Bitcoin service providers to personal custody. I think there's enough free-floating Bitcoin in personal custody to sustain the distributed nature of the protocol in that way. And again, the jurisdictional arbitrage that comes into play on a global scale, like I just don't see any attempt to do that type of banning of Bitcoin self-custody actually being successful. So all it takes is one defector to draw in talent and capital to throw a wrench in that plan.
That was a really impactful episode for me. I thought it seemed like a highlight for you. It seemed like he was someone that you really appreciated his writing. It was a really, the episode had a real journey and arc to it where I think we were all rooting that he would get it. And I think we all came away a little disheartened that he didn't. I really liked his analogies, or just in general for the world, about the coyotes and the raccoons. I've used that in other avenues. And it was interesting, I heard him on Clubhouse the other day, and there hasn't been an evolution on Bitcoin at all, it seems, but his thinking on the maybe the one, this is what I'm looking for, but like that could hurt Bitcoin is still that, like, it could be neutered by these large organizations, by Wall Street. And he kept pointing to Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and Fidelity getting involved and just scooping up so much. And it's interesting, though, because I don't agree with him, but I still, I like the way he thinks. I'm still trying to struggle with, like, or just be open to where the weak spots are so that I'm never, I don't have my guard down, you know? And it's still interesting that him personally, 3-4 years later is just, or 2 years later, has not really changed at all, but dug in more. So it still resonates more because I'll still pull on that thread to hear where it might go. But, and the reason where I'm going with this is I think that we're still headed for another large war though. And I don't know if the crypto council for the future is a tip off to that, or are we headed towards another sort of block size war 2.0? With larger institutions and organizations. And I'm not saying they'll win, but do we need to guard ourselves and steel ourselves for more huge battles?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's not going to be easy. Number go up's good, and number has been going up, and it makes it seem very easy. But I think, yeah, it'd be stupid to think that there's not going to be significant pushback from the powers that be. So, yeah, we should prepare for it, prepare for the worst, hope for the best, hope that just the pure incentives of the network reduce the need for that type of friction in battle, but don't ever take it for granted and expect that it won't happen. But with that being said, like, I think Bitcoin's going to win at the end. Like, it's too distributed. Like, the way they'd try to neuter this would be like forcing people to use KYC wallets via centralized parties. And there's already better products out there, like BTC Pay Server. Like, that's the other, like that product alone, like getting that free and open source software into the hands of individuals who can just accept Bitcoin payments directly to wallets that they control, is such a better experience in terms of having control over your money compared to the sort of neutered Bitcoin system that these regulators would want to create. That it's just like at a consumer level, it's a no-brainer. They're going to choose the open source software, and if they have the ability to download the software, they're going to use it. And they're trying to institute a war on drugs, which is a weird thing to think about. Even though all these drugs were illegal, people were buying and selling them still. And the prices of those drugs increased significantly because there was a premium on having access to them in a world in which they were illegal. Bitcoin, and I don't expect anything different. So yeah, there will be a battle, but I think, especially in the digital age, these battles get easier to fight. Like the meme battle, the meme war is upon us. We've got the best meme makers in the world. Like, you can literally, we're smarter than these people too. Like, when it comes down to like understanding objective truth and working from first principles, there's so many Bitcoiners and people in the space that have been working on this and explaining this and debating this for over a decade now, that I would be very confident in just in the battle of ideas, Bitcoiners winning pretty handily, because it's literally freedom versus tyranny and totalitarianism in the digital age. And I think Bitcoiners are getting better at distilling that message and communicating it very clearly. And once you pose that to people, like, hey, you can get this totalitarianism, social credit system where you're forced to spend money a certain way and you're forced to use your money a certain way, where you can get freedom in the digital age with Bitcoin. It's going to be a battle, but it's going to be a battle of ideas, right? And we won the battle of ideas before in the past with SegWit 2x. I think we'll win the future. And again, the people that we're up against, like the people at the Financial Action Task Force, FinCEN, all these weird, obscure regulatory bodies that are so disconnected from reality and the average Joe, they're not going to win, I don't think. I mean, the trust in institutions, particularly political institutions, is at all-time lows. To think that these old geriatric kleptocrats are going to be able to actually win the battle of ideas is pretty generous, I think.
Right. Speaking of like ideas and first principles and trust in institutions, you know, one of the reasons I really enjoyed your show or enjoy your show is because I enjoy your opinions and your takes. And that's one of the reasons I tune in weekly. And I remember distinctly, you know, you and Matt O'Dell having a conversation about COVID back in February and March. And I expected both of you to be on the same page and maybe take Matt's side and sort of like, it's all about liberty and freedom. And, you know, but I was taken aback when you had a different point of view. And I don't know what your point of view is, but to me at the time, it was just it was a moment of caution is how I'll frame it up. And sort of like, well, the unknown is here or is coming and let's take a step back. And so that had a big effect on me because, you know, when you think about the news or mainstream media, most of it is opinions or hot takes because, you know, things are on the fly. It's news. It's what happened today. And so I'm kind of curious, like, what do you think of mainstream media and news speak and where we are with COVID today?
God, I think it's exhausting. It's disgusting. They use rhetorical tools to drive people to fear to get them to act in certain ways. And COVID is stripping civil liberties, right? It's really weird what's going on right now. Like the whole debate around vaccinations, to me, so like, again, first principles, like in the beginning of COVID, I was like scared shitless, seeing videos of people dropping like in streets and getting welded into their apartments. Like, what the fuck is going on? I was a new father. My son was born in the middle of February. So I had like an infant. All this was going on, living in a studio in Brooklyn. I'm scared shitless, just being inundated with everything that was going around Twitter and in the mainstream. So in the beginning, it was like precautionary principle, like, all right, let's err on the side of caution. Let's get out of Brooklyn. Let's get away from a large population. And just in case this thing is really something to be scared of, which I mean, like it's a virus that it exists like for certain people and certain demographics with certain health characteristics. It is certainly something to be scared of, but I think as time went on and we saw Cuomo and Fauci come out and change the narrative around mass social distancing, hide the nursing home deaths, like it became very obvious to me pretty quickly within the first few months of the lockdown. So it was complete bullshit. Like the powers that be were trying to leverage this to force some weird control over the populace. And again, it comes back to like logical inconsistencies, like the mask rules being one, like the mask number one, like piece of the cloth that really are not going to stop the virus particles at all. And then two, it's like, what the hell is going on? Like, again, I tweeted about it a couple of weeks ago. Like it's just like infuriating. Like you go to a restaurant and you wear a mask at the hostess stand, and then you go to sit down at your table, you can rip it off, and people can like walk by you, like with mask off. Like another thing is like the magical coffee cup. Like if you're on a flight, and you have coffee or a drink, or you're walking down the street, like when you have coffee or a drink, and you have your mask off and you're drinking, people don't say anything about it. But if you're just walking down the street without anything in your hands, people like freak out. There's like many logical inconsistencies, and then like the rush of the vaccine rollout and like the narrative, like the just weird narratives, like being like in cities and having the radio come on randomly and just hearing propaganda, like make sure you get vaccinated, save a life. And it's being pushed on you by a pharmaceutical industry that's not really cared about people's health in the past. You're talking about like Pfizer, a company that's been sued for billions of dollars in the past for putting bad drugs on the market and forcing bad drugs on people, like opioids and stuff like that. And it's, I mean, we had today, like the whole like media within this, just trying to force like a moralization on this weird sort of pandemic. It's like, it became very transparent to me early on, you know, like trying to force compliance, force people to feel a certain way. If they didn't wear a mask, they don't get a vaccine. Meanwhile, people are skeptical, like, is the mask really doing anything? Like, why can you wear a mask? Why do you have to wear a mask at the host's table, but not when you're eating or walking like around your table? Well, it's not like logically consistent. The NCAA tournament, you have all the players while they're on the court, like literally rubbing up on each other, no mask. And the coach is on the sidelines wearing a mask, but when he wants to get his players' attention, he pulls it down and screams at them. And it's just like if you're going to take your mask off at any point, like it's not going to save you. So that logical inconsistency, like, just rubs me wrong. And yesterday when I landed here in Austin, like United, like we're all like sitting, like we got on the plane, there was no social distancing rules. Like just like bored, we're all waiting in line at the, between the plane and the gate and the plane and that like tube. But when we got off the plane, we're like, all right, we're going to deplane two rows at a time for social distancing. It's like, what the fuck? We were just like on this flight for 5 hours. We didn't do this when we got on. It's all logically inconsistent to me. It's just very frustrating. And then like with the vaccine stuff, people are like, hey, maybe like a rushed mRNA vaccine that hasn't been tested, technically not FDA approved. Maybe like I don't feel like getting that. I'm a young, healthy 29-year-old. My demographic has luckily not been really affected by this virus in terms of deaths. Like my demographic, there's less than 3,000 people that have died from it in the U.S., which is a very, very small percentage of the people that fall within my demographic. So the risk-reward for the vaccine for myself just doesn't make sense to me, but I get scolded by family members and people who I articulate that thought to. And then today, you have the government come out and stop the distribution of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It's causing blood clots in people. And it's like, hey, this is what I was skeptical of, and you called me a murderer because I didn't want to get a vaccine. I'll probably get canceled for this, but like I don't care like anymore. It's like fucking, it's all bullshit. It's not logically consistent. And it does seem like they're using it to control. Like they're trying to force a vaccine passport on people now, which is like terrible. It's very Orwellian, very totalitarian. And it's for things like going to restaurants that I'm already doing without a vaccine, like, and doing perfectly fine. It's all very weird. It's all very creepy too.
Yeah. I don't think we're going back to anything that was before though. Personally, I think this narrative idea is here to stay. Do you think fatherhood has really affected your outlook on these things? Meaning not so much certain issues that are just about you, but like about the world. Would you care less if you weren't a father right now? Or didn't become a father, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would still care a lot, but I think I would certainly care less. It's scary, like having a 14-month-old in this world where they're really, I mean, it's like I fucking seeing kids, like 4-year-old kids, 5-year-old, 6-year-old kids go to school at mask. It's terrifying. It's like, what are we doing to the psychology of this whole generation? Again, they're not susceptible to this virus. Like it's a weird virtue signal. It's not logically consistent with the data. And the kids are at their most malleable age, and they're being force-fed this fear-mongering and told they have to wear this mask or they're going to get a virus that kills them, which isn't the truth. Like, they're not going to – most of them aren't going to die. Like, the vast majority of them, they're not going to get the virus, let alone die from it. And yet we're forcing this fear narrative on these children at their most malleable stage in life. Like, what are the knock-on – systemic effects from that as they get older, now their worldview get constructed, and how is that affected when they're teenagers in their mid-20s and their 30s, and what kind of ripple effects does that have on the future of society? And so yeah, like a son is luckily like younger than two, so you don't have to force them to wear a mask on a plane, which is like the most disgusting thing in the world. Like I feel very lucky that he's not 2 years old yet. I will never force him to wear a mask on a like for this particular virus. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I mean, it makes me care a lot because I want him to have a great life, right? And enjoy life. And this is no way to enjoy life. They're really taking the joy out of life with all this and switching it out with fear.
Yeah. What do you think you can do for his education?
I don't know. Well, I like the idea of unschooling and doing pods with people who are like-minded. I like that idea. But we're a few years away from that, so need to see how that develops and see where everything goes. I mean, I went to a monastery school for pre-K and kindergarten. I wouldn't mind if my son did the same, my children do the same. I like that sort of structure of learning.
I did Montessori, yeah. But we didn't do that for my kids. What do you think about the use of children in political and media campaigns?
I mean, just playing to people's emotions. I mean, Greta Thunberg is the greatest example of that right now. In today's age, you got a 16-year-old crying about the environment, used as a political tool to push a certain agenda. And yeah, I think it's disgusting. Particularly if the children don't really understand what's going on or how they're being used as pawns in a larger political game. But I think it's uncouth. I don't think people should do that, but they do.
Yeah.
People love to incite the children.
And what do you think about Janet Yellen and the global minimum tax? And just, I think the idea right now of just like being able to vote with your feet and sort of like maybe those opportunities being stripped away.
Yeah, I mean, it's scary, right? Like the, you have the mismanagement of the global economy and the global monetary system because you have these very few individuals throughout the world who think they can micromanage a complex system like the economy of a country like the United States or the global economy. And I mean, just this takes it to another degree to think that you could have a global tax. Like, again, I wrote about it last week or the week before. Like, how do you collect that tax? How do you distribute it? What does it get distributed to? How are you transparent with that? It seems like a logistical nightmare and something that is just primed to get exploited by kleptocrats.
Right. What about the green energy jobs? Is that like, are there going to be a lot of green energy jobs, or is what's going on with like the notion of that and as an economy and where we're trying to go with energy?
I mean, I don't know exactly how many jobs would produce. I just know that they won't be as good. I mean, if you're trying to replace jobs of people working in the oil and gas industry with quote unquote green energy jobs, I mean, just objectively, they don't pay as much. They're not as profitable because the energy that's being produced via the labor of those jobs that will be produced is not economically dense, specifically as economically dense as oil and gas. Just from a pure physics perspective, like the amount of value provided via fossil fuel molecules compared to the green energy sector outside of nuclear. Nuclear provides an immense amount of value and economic density, but that's another tell in the green energy movement. It's not really about green energy. It's more about control over people's lives, as they don't really push nuclear, which is the cleanest energy and the most economically dense.
It's really interesting, the narrative of pushback against nuclear. I think back about just, you know, growing up, how many narratives I've believed or, you know, just around, and some of those issues we talked about, one of them is just nuclear energy bad or scary or, you know, no, dude, it's fine, but you don't want to live near it kind of thing. you know, it's just astounding. I do want to turn to sort of Web 3.0 and a little bit around like where Bitcoin can go and the network itself, specifically with different layered technology. So you had a quote, I think in your newsletter, the Web 3.0 that Gavin and everyone else in Ethereum land envisioned would be made up of four components: static content publication, dynamic messages, trustless transactions, and an integrated user interface. Can you kind of expand on how, like, what Sphinx is doing with the way in which they allow podcasters to monetize their platform, checks all four of those boxes and what those boxes mean?
Yeah, and so Sphinx, the way it's letting podcasters monetize, it's basically just it's creating a UI on the podcasting 2.0 platform, which is integrating the Lightning Network, right? So essentially you're adding the Lightning Network and integrated into RSS feeds, which is pretty massive. Like, RSS feeds are a way to distribute content in distributed fashion, very, very decentralized, very, very widespread. You send out your content via RSS feed. It could be picked up by multiple platforms, multiple apps that basically just tap into your RSS feed. And so what Sphinx does for podcasting RSS feeds specifically is it taps into their RSS feed, and particularly ones that have enabled the value block within the RSS feed, which allows you to insert a Lightning Network public node, or excuse me, public address of a public node that allows individuals listening to your podcast to stream Satoshis to you. And so Sphinx has created a UI and a sort of node hosting service on top of this podcasting 2.0 platform. So they basically pull the RSS feed into the app and allow you to listen to the podcast, and they activate the value block or take advantage of the value block being initiated by the podcaster, who includes a Lightning node address, and they allow the individuals listening via the app to send Satoshis to podcasters. So as people listen to Tales from the Crypt, your podcast on the Sphinx chat, they're able to basically determine how much value you're providing them, and they'll pay you that amount of value in Satoshis. They can stream you a sat per minute. They can stream you 10 sats per minute, 100,000, if they so wish. That's all enabled because Sphinx has created a UI and a wallet, a Lightning Network wallet app that allows you to do this. And so beyond that, it's more, you can create these tribes where you can interact with your listeners, right? You can have conversations with them and create a community. And then within that community, that you can distribute value and sort of tip each other within your tribe for value created. So in like Web 3.0, you have the UI on top of the distributed communication network. So that's the chatting app aspect of the Sphinx chat. You're actually sending messages over the Lightning Network. Like, you're encrypting messages on your Lightning Network node, and you're sending it through the Lightning Network, through Lightning channels, and the people on the other end are receiving it on their nodes, which is pretty insane to think about. You're creating a messaging protocol on Lightning that's moving around via the value protocol, value exchange protocol that is the Lightning Network. And so, yeah, Sphinx has integrated podcasting 2.0, so allows podcasters to monetize. Podcasting 2.0 allows podcasters to monetize, and Sphinx is allowed a way for listeners of podcasts to participate in that functionality. And then it's created services, additive services on top of that. So podcasting is just one way. So like Breeze Wild is also integrated podcasting 2.0, and there's a few other apps that have done it as well. So they're all just tapping into this open RSS feed with a value block inserted into it and leveraging it, which is pretty beautiful. So you have distributed content, you know, distribution via RSS feed combined with Lightning Network, and you can create really cool applications with it. Yeah. You're just combining different distributed systems together instead of trying to do it all on a blockchain.
Right. I'm super bullish on it just from a very high level, because I think it's what we need as a society, this sort of decentralized open platform to communicate and exchange value. I think my biggest drawback to it, or I see sort of the obstacle in front, is that I don't know how much people want to pay per transaction for these kinds of things at such a low rate, you know, a penny for a tweet or those kinds of things. But I do hope that it's a mechanism to bring, to even bring better speech and expression and freedom of expression. I'm kind of curious, what do you think are the most important attributes of the Bitcoin network? And kind of along those lines of what kind of drew you to Bitcoin? Was it the savings technology, or was it Austrian economics? Was it the privacy or the technology, or sort of these, what we can do with Web 3.0? What was it for you that really brought you in?
Definitely the economics. I mean, again, I was working at that managed futures fund, following currency markets, and I was pretty jaded by the financial system. I was a senior in high school when 2008 happened, when the great financial crisis happened. I just so happened to be taking an elective economics course in November of 2008, when everything, September, October, November, when everything was hitting the fan, and the aftermath of shit hitting the fan was going down, and you just went over everything that was going down in fine detail within that class. And at 17, I was like, what the fuck is it? Like, how is it this bad? And so I went to college with like a sort of know your enemy mentality, started interning at the fund, and nature of that job, following Fed policy. And over the course of a few years of following their policies, between Bernanke and Janet Yellen, really coming at an early age to call bullshit. Like, these people have no idea what they're doing. They don't make any sense. They're not logically consistent. At the same time, falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And so Bitcoin's perfect monetary policy, as Pierre Richard likes to describe it, is what drew me in. The fact that it was this set in stone distribution of Bitcoins at a very predictable rate, compared, put that in juxtaposition of the Fed and its quantitative easing and sort of shoot from the hip approach they had to monetary policy. The juxtaposition of those two things is sort of what led me to Bitcoin. Bitcoin really represented stability in an age of chaos in the monetary realm, in my regard. So that's what drew me to it. And then obviously, as everybody does with the Bitcoin rabbit hole, fall headfirst in, and you start learning about every other aspect, which is the cypherpunk movement, the distributed systems nature of the protocol, which enables this liberty in the digital age that really doesn't exist. And you realize that that distributed nature is what sort of enforces the set in stone monetary policy. So they all work together. So yeah, I came for the sound monetary policy and stayed for the combination of the monetary policy with the distributed nature of the system that enables censorship resistant transactions and allows you to use fuck you money.
Right. Do you remember you had a famous tweet, at least it was for me, and I heard about it after the fact, and I think I re-looked it up, but like, I think it was around Bitcoin hit 5,000, and it's a shot, it's just like a gif of a convertible and a couple like driving off. And I think it's kind of like, honey, you know, we wake up and today it's 5,000. And it was kind of like your amazement, I think, at sort of where Bitcoin was at that moment in time. And I wonder, like, as long as you've been around, and like, is there another price that would kind of like blow you away in that regard? Not so much, you know, in terms of monetary economics, but just for yourself, but in terms of Bitcoin and how far it's gone.
No, now, I mean, so this was like fall of 2017, and it was so having been around Bitcoin since like 2013, really head first into studying Bitcoin 2014, and going through that bear market, 2015 was a very, very dark time in the Bitcoin world, and going down to like $180 at one point, and then hovering down in the low hundreds for considerable amount of time. And like there was no Bitcoin Twitter. Bitcoin Twitter was not what it is today. There was very few people who hung around during that time. And I wasn't even active. I was more of a lurker at that time. Just had my list on Twitter and was following the space pretty intently, consuming as much content as possible, not really involved publicly at all. And I think at some points in 2015, 2016, I was like, ah, shit, this might not happen. And so that tweet, coming from those lows, particularly like we climbed out of those depths, like in the fall of 2016. So seeing everything go from how desolate it was and how depressing it was in 2015, 2016 to $5,000, which seemed unfathomable during those years, was like a holy shit moment. And now having produced content and studied the space and getting more involved on the mining side, and seeing what's going on in that world, I'm just more convinced than ever that this is inevitable. Again, the incentives are so strong. The mind share is so strong. I think we've reached a cultural tipping point of understanding and acceptance when it comes to Bitcoin as something that's going to stay. I think it is going to take over the world. And I don't think, I mean, I have pretty high expectations for the future valuation of the network, considering the potential value that it's going to suck out of other markets. Like I'm in Bitcoin teen land now. I think it's going to shock people to the upside.
I hear you. Do you ever envision yourself having a conversation face to face with Dave Portnoy?
Yeah, I think Dave and I will talk at some point again in the future. We'll be down to Miami for Bitcoin 2021. He lives in Miami now. You know, I'm sure we'll. I wouldn't be surprised if we bump elbows again. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm back in the Barstool offices again at some point.
Did you ever meet him prior to Bitcoin or even at Barstool? Did you ever meet him personally before? If you were to meet him, would this be the first time or the second time or many times?
No, I mean, I worked for him. I
talked. You met him before?
Yeah, I mean, I used to write the ads on the board for the Daily Rundown.
And did you ever give him a spiel about Bitcoin?
Oh yeah, I set him up with wallets. Like I've given him the spiel.
Because it seems like, you know, like he seems to repeat receiving the spiel. Like, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, so Dave. So you have to realize about Barstool and the genius of Dave Portnoy. The genius of Dave Portnoy is that he knows how to lean into a subject when it is hot. And fall, winter of 2017, 2018, like Bitcoin and quote unquote crypto was the hot thing. So yeah, I talked to him a lot during that because he wanted to know how to lean into that content wave. But as with most attention waves, not just specific to Bitcoin, like any story you hear in the media, it's pretty ephemeral. So as soon as Bitcoin price started falling and everybody started leaving the crypto market, like everything just on to the next thing. And so and Dave Portnoy lives a chaotic life where he's creating content all the time, talking to very famous people all the time and just jumping from one thing to the next, very aggressive businessman, very savvy businessman. So he's doing many things. And yes, I'm not sure if my spiel stuck with him and is sitting in his mind, but I definitely did give him the spiel. I was preaching DCA while at Barstool. There's a lot of revisionist history in the Barstool office about what Bitcoin Marty was spreading. But yeah, I was telling people not to buy shit coins and to ease into it and understand it and learn about it. And yeah, I do know for sure that Dave has Bitcoin on a wallet somewhere. I don't know. I'm pretty sure he doesn't know where it is, but if he would ever find it, I think he'd be happily surprised.
Right. I just wonder, because I think of him as super smart. I don't know. I don't always love or appreciate the content. I wonder why he produces so much content if he's already so successful. I don't know if he just loves producing or he needs it to continue to drive the business personally if the business wouldn't succeed without him. But I just wonder on the Bitcoin front, it seems like he's being really obtuse. And I don't know if it's like a role or a character or if he's incentivized to just never acknowledge it intellectually or if he gets it and he's, like I said, playing a role or just doesn't.
He's not playing. he's not playing a role. Like the Dave Portnoy you see is the real Dave Portnoy. He's like that on and off the camera, from my experience at least. And again, I haven't seen or talked to Dave in, gosh, 3.5, almost 4 years now. Who knows, DJ? I mean, yeah, maybe that's. I mean, he'd be the first to tell you too. Dave Portnoy loves himself. He's creating content. I mean, that's how he got to where he is too. It's like, it's one of his famous sayings is the blog never sleeps, content, content, content. He became a 100 millionaire because he woke up every day and produced content nonstop for 12 years. So I think it's just part of his nature, right?
Is he like similar to Bill Simmons like that, where they're just like living the role or like they created for themselves? I don't know, but I also feel like it's, the ego seems to be a huge part of the character.
I mean, it's not a character. It is Dave
Portnoy. Right, right. Fair enough.
And he would be very, very, very insulted to know that he was compared to Bill Simmons.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's interesting. Did you learn a lot at Barstool about media and marketing?
Yeah, I mean, again, I respect the hell out of Dave Portnoy. I do. And so, like, something I try to apply to TFTC is blog never sleeps. You got to always be producing content. Consistency is key. And being able to get a pulse on what is important at any given point in time is important to being successful. So that's something I try to emulate with the podcast and the newsletter. So in terms of like how to lean into content and dedicate yourself to producing content, certainly learned an immense amount while at Barstool, and even just observing Barstool before I got there. I watched the blog grow over the years. I was an early reader and a fan of Barstool before working there, and then finally getting to see how the sausage is made. Definitely learned a lot. And then on the ad sales, yeah, I learned the nature of the podcast ad sales game, which for my personal well-being and my career has turned out to be a very good skill to learn. I don't need somebody else to do that for me, which is what a lot of podcasters do. They'll go do a network and say, hey, like, come join our network. We'll sell ads for you. Like, I know how the podcasting ad game works and know how to negotiate that stuff for myself. And so it allows me to make better deals, keep more revenue.
Right. I'm curious your take on Clubhouse, and not so much the app or the company, but that format or medium, whether Twitter rolls out the same thing or whoever. What do you think of that medium?
I think it's interesting, but it gets old after a while. Like, I was on Clubhouse pretty consistently for like 3 months, like every day, and then just got old and just recycled the same conversations and becomes a huge time suck. I think part of Clubhouse success is the forced lockdown, people's longing for connection and water cooler like conversations. And there's only so much of that I personally can partake in before it's like, all right, this is old. I'm wasting too much time. I think it's useful. I like Clubhouse when it's very focused conversations. That's the only time I'll use it now, is when there's like a very focused, dedicated topic that's going to be spoken about for an hour, very close-ended, very regimented, if you will. It's interesting. For me, it's just like, I was on it and after a couple months, I was like, these are all the same conversations. Mm-hmm. It's not producing much value to me. And the opportunity cost of spending time on Clubhouse versus actually getting stuff done was getting too high for me.
Yeah, seems like more noise than signal. So I'm kind of curious, usually I ask people the long term, but I'm kind of curious the short term. What is your outlook for 2021 and maybe outside of Bitcoin, just your take on what's going on?
I think you're going to see the trend of states exerting their rights and competing for citizens continue. I think that's a very good theme to see happening right now. And I think that's going to grow stronger throughout the year, particularly around the vaccine passport debate. I think you're going to see different states posturing different ways in regards to that particular debate. Yeah, I think you're going to see a continuation of the collapse in trust in the political system. I mean, the hypocrisy. I think people are, some individuals are having buyer's remorse when it comes to Joe Biden being our president. Like, it's pretty obvious that he's mentally incapacitated to a certain degree. He's not following through on many of the promises that he made. He's trying to take away people's guns. He's not doing anything about border security. He's got a witch for a vice president. I think people are beginning to notice that the narratives that were being spun leading up to the election from president, vice president, and that political party are just Trojan horses to get into office and continue the meet the old boss, same of the old boss nature of our political system, where you're not really going to exert change or bring change to the United States via the political process. I don't think, at least, unless it's like local state. I think, again, you're going to see the trend of the state governments and competing at the state level increase as people lose faith at the federal level, because these people are crooks. It's becoming more blatantly obvious by the day. I think it's just insane. Nancy Pelosi just got called out for making a huge call option bet on Microsoft like a couple of weeks before they got granted like a huge $2 billion government funding or something like that, or they were awarded some contract. It's becoming blatantly obvious that these people don't care about the average Joe, the common man, and in fact, they're actually trying to divide them. Use divide, conquer, confuse, again, use these rhetorical tools based from fear to divide people to actually bring forth like a very totalitarian system. Hopefully more people wake up to that. And I think people are starting to, people are starting to get fed up with the bullshit. So yeah, I think number one thing I'm looking for as we finish 2021 is this growing trend of states trying to court individual citizens and continuation of the decline in trust in our federal government.
Yeah, I agree. I'm definitely voting with my feet. I'm moving, probably. It looks like it. And it's interesting times. I don't have a very positive outlook for this year, I guess, is my tell-all. I think things are still going to be choppy. And I think that the greater narrative is bigger than the ideas that we're putting forward in this conversation. But I'm optimistic that you're optimistic. And I'm optimistic long term.
Yeah.
I always worry about the short term and just what we might go through.
Yeah. I mean, just like Bitcoin, I think we're going to have a good year. What I'm seeing from the Great American Mining perspective is very encouraging. I think it's happening. The Bitcoin thing is, and that's extremely optimistic. And it is optimistic of people keep losing faith in the federal government. Like, again, these logical inconsistencies just become more and more blatantly obvious. Again, like the vaccine, the rush vaccine rollout and the moralization around the vaccine. And then 6 months into the distribution of the vaccine, you have to recall and suspend the distribution of one of the major ones they've been forcing on the populace because of things that many people were worried about. I think it causes pause and people to say, wait a second, are we supposed to be trusting everything you say? I mean, it's hard.
Well, I've never trusted anything. I've always been kind of a little anti messaging, but I think as a father, I'm really nervous about all the moralization of everything, because it affects my children. And I don't have a problem with morals. I like a moral society. I just think those the teaching of the morals should be in the home, and should be less federally mandated. I don't mean in the home, like I'm the only one who can teach my kid morals, but I wish there was less of federal messaging around morals and, you know, that
should be a local, yeah, it should be a local community thing. You should learn from your family, your cousins, and then your school, your classmates, and your local community, and treating each other well. And yeah, I agree, we should have a moral society. I think what the government is doing is completely immoral and evil. And yeah, I think, again, the move towards more localized decision making is good for that. Yeah, I'm extremely optimistic because I think people are starting to realize this is getting too far gone. And the moralization, and that's one thing I've been saying frequently on Gamcast and Tales from the Crypt more and more and in personal conversations. Just like, we need strong men and women stand up and start talking back against this bullshit. Like, just call out the bullshit. Like, this is not logically consistent. This doesn't make sense. Like, you're using fear to divide people and get a certain agenda pushed on the populace. Like, there's no more. People got to stop worrying about getting canceled and just start speaking up and saying, this is like literally called bullshit. Like, I'm sorry. I don't care. I'm on the side of truth. Like, and this has gotten to a point where it's insane. I think the silent majority has been pushed to an extreme where they're ready to stop being as silent as they have been in the past, because it's leading us to weird territory. And the fact that we have Bitcoin as an escape route and a way to exit and opt out of the system is just a beautiful option to have, and very grateful that we do have the option. And again, like, I'm happy that I'm able to focus on making the Bitcoin dream become a reality, because by creating the content that I create and creating the mining infrastructure that we're building on a Great American Mining, we're literally building the system that we can use as an escape valve from this totalitarian, evil federal government that's metastasized throughout our country.
Yeah. Well, I really, I love and appreciate your fortitude and your optimism during all of this and your outlook. I can't tell you how much I've appreciated this and everything you do in the space. I'm a big fan of your work. I can't imagine how hard it is to put a newsletter out every day. I know writing is never easy for anyone. But it definitely was a big part of my journey, the newsletter and the pod. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on. And I think there's no other show that's more forward-looking in the space, on the cutting edge of not just technical issues like Sphinx and Lightning, but and privacy, but really cultural issues and social issues, like your interviews with Whitney Webb and Michael Krieger. So I love your stuff, man. Thank you so much for coming on the pod. Definitely let everyone know where they could find you. And just a shout out for Gamcast. I also like that one a lot. I've been listening to that lately. That's a cool new addition to your portfolio. So definitely let people know where they could find you.
Cedric, thank you for having me on. I'm very flattered that you enjoy the content. Again, it's like a labor. I mean, I do make money off of it now, but started out as a labor of love, and I still like to think about it as a labor of love, because I think Bitcoin's an imperative moving forward for liberty in the digital age. And even if I wasn't getting paid for it, I don't think I'd be stopping. But if you want to find my content, tftc.io is the website where in the newsletter and the podcast, you can find all of it in one spot. We're available on Tales from the Crypt and Gamcast. So Great American Mining is separate, obviously, from my media company. You can find information about Great American Mining at gam.ai, gam.ai. In Gamcast, there's a link to the podcast on that site. I hang out on Twitter at Marty Bent. That's where you can find me. I'll be producing content and trying to plug in miners as much as possible until I fall over dead. So, I enjoy it. Cedric, thank you for having me, and thank you for doing this. It's beautiful to see more and more people popping up and educating others about Bitcoin. I think this just adds to the feedback loop and the network effect that's going to ensure that Bitcoin succeeds in the long run. So keep crushing it, man.
Yeah, man, I agree 100%. Thank you so much. This has been so dope.
Marty Bent calls bullshit on all of it right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, make sure to subscribe, write a 5-star review, and share the link with your friends and family. For those of you that need to start stacking sats or want the best place to dollar cost average and get $10 of Bitcoin free on me, sign up at swanbitcoin.com/Cedric Jungelman. Keep learning and keep stacking. This is Cedric. Peace.